Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. A very happy Thursday afternoon to you here, or Thursday evening or Friday morning, depending on where you are. So nice. I love the summer. I just love the summer. July 6th. It's beautiful out. What a beautiful day. And I'm guessing anyways, because we're pre-recording this, but we'll talk about that in a minute why we're pre-recording this. But it's an open forum, and it's an internet open forum. And of course, that means Jimmy Akin is here, senior apologist at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live.
Why did I get that? Why did I get host?
Because that's the way you said it before. I thought it was your proper title.
Oh, did I say it like that?
Yeah.
I just love July 6th. It's one of my favorite days of the year. I love this early July weather we're having. It's great. Edgar's getting married today.
Yeah. Congratulations, Edgar.
As a matter of fact, when this airs, Edgar will already be married. So let me be the first to congratulate you on your wedding, Edgar.
And let me be the second.
Yep. Jimmy, thanks very much for being here. Tomorrow will be Friday, July 7th. So what do you got on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
We're going to be talking about a Lakota medicine man who, being a medicine man, had a lot of paranormal experiences, including visions and out-of-body experiences. He participated in some very famous battles with U.S. forces, with federal forces, in the late 1800s. He lived into the mid-1900s, and his name is Black Elk. So we'll be telling you about Black Elk and his life as a medicine man. And then the following week, we're going to be telling you about a completely different side of Black Elk's life that various historians have tried to hide.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh. And that's so this is a two-parter?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. All right. Very good. I can't remember that Western painter, Russell, I think. There's a painting of the medicine man. The medicine man was more important than anybody else in the tribe for certain things
For certain things, it's like saying, men were doctors. And so it's like saying a doctor is the most important person in society for certain things. Well, if you've got a disease, yeah.
Well, this picture it's of the medicine man leading the tribe on their migration. And I don't know why he was picked as the leader for the migration, but he would be out in front.
That would depend on the group. There are various tribal nomadic and semi-nomadic peoples around the world that where the medicine man. So medicine in this context it's not just what we think of as medicine. Historically, medicine has been tied up with what we would consider magic or ritual or religion. So it's medicine in that broader sense. And in various tribal cultures, like I took a course in paranthropology once about this, which is the anthropology of the parapsychological. And in various tribal cultures, it's the medicine man's job or shaman's job to locate food and game.
Oh, and why he's out front.
And they have various ways of doing that. Like, for example, in some cultures, they will take like the shoulder bones of their prey animals and heat them in fire so that they crack. And then it's the medicine man's or the shaman's job, same thing. It's the medicine man or shaman's job to read the cracks and discern where the game is currently located so the hunters can go get it and get food for the tribe.
Oh, very, very interesting. Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to that. Black Elk. That drops tomorrow. They always drop Friday morning, get a new one. There's hundreds of them. And if you're not exposed to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, all kinds of mysteries investigated over there, just go to mysterious.fm, mysterious.fm, or just search Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and you'll find it. It's an internet open forum this hour. All the questions are already in, so just relax and enjoy that. And I am ready to go, Jimmy, if you are ready to go.
Sure.
This one's from Sean. And I kind of like these really long questions because I get to participate. Let's see if I can read this all the way through. In the three temptations, or he says tests, of Christ, two things Satan used to test Jesus were to see if he was the Son of God by having him turn stones into bread and by casting himself off a high place, the peak of the temple, to show that angels would protect him. But the other test, I thought, might be to see if Jesus was just an ordinary man with no divinity. Bow down and worship Satan, and he will give you all these kingdoms. If Jesus is the Son of God, then he doesn't need to do so to have those kingdoms. So two tests, if you can do these things, you're the Son of God. One test, if you do this, then you're just an ordinary man. What with all the other, what with all the government-caused inflation, is that some... Wait, oh, I'm sorry. I messed that up. You're just an ordinary man. My question, and I know I've taken a long time to get here, what with all the government-caused inflation, is that someone else, has someone else in the church thought of this possibility? I can't be the first person in almost 2,000 years of church history. And of course, I'm interested in your take on this, regardless of whether it's been previously addressed.
So I agree with you, Sean. It's unlikely that you're the first person to think of this interpretation in 2,000 years of church history, given that there are, you know, now billions of Christians. So I think this has probably been thought of before. I don't know anyone who's done that, who's made this specific proposal, but it's certainly something I'm sure various individuals have imagined. In terms of my take on it, I think it's possible, but I don't know that it would be my preferred interpretation. I think that you can read these temptations another way. For example, it doesn't require that you be God in order to subject yourself to the first two tests. You know, God could manufacture food out of stones for an ordinary person. I mean, Jesus elsewhere multiplies bread to provide food miraculously. He elsewhere turns water into wine for ordinary people to consume. And so God could turn stones into bread for an ordinary person to consume. Similarly, you have God's protection being provided for people in dangerous situations. And if someone leapt off of a tall height, God could send his angels to carry the person. In fact, there's even one reported instance of levitation in the Old Testament where God sends an angel who basically grabs a prophet by the hair and carries him off. So God could do that for an ordinary person like a prophet. You don't have to be the Messiah. On the flip side, with the kingdoms test, I don't think have to be the Son of God to pass that test or to fail that test. What the offer he's making Jesus is a quick and easy way to inherit the kingdoms of the world. He doesn't have to accept this offer in order to get the kingdoms, but if he doesn't accept this offer, he's going to have to go to the cross. And so what this would represent is a way for Jesus to take the quick and easy path to the dark side and get the kingdoms of the world without going to the cross. So I think that in terms of the God or man question, you can read each of the three tests in different ways. And I don't know that it was exactly the God or man question that Satan was focused on. He could have been, you know, focused on it and trying to figure out, okay, is this apparent man actually God? Or he could have been more focused on the question, is Jesus the Messiah? Because it was promised to the Messiah that he would inherit the kingdoms of the world. And so he may be viewing things through that lens.
Sean, thank you very, very much. Thanks for getting us started. It's Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, right back with more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Faith is a precious gift from God. As the largest religious media network in the world, EWTN has an important role in educating others about our Catholic faith and spreading the good news of salvation. We invite you to explore our numerous pages of historical faith documents, prayers, teachings, and other current issues in Catholicism today. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Sorry, Sean, for messing up your joke about inflation there.
It's an in-joke on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Whenever I mention inflation, whenever I mention how monetary values have changed,
yeah,
I always mention, due to all the inflation the government has caused.
Yeah. And then I messed up that one line, Sean. So, but thanks. It was a very, very good question. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is here. It's internet open forum. All the questions have come to us via the internet. And Damon asks this: what are all the sacraments that angels can administer? Are there any they can confect? I've heard of angels administering the Eucharist to people, and I've also heard a story in which someone went to confession, and afterwards, when they saw the priest and told them about it, the priest said he was nowhere near the church at that time, and it was said that an angel appeared as the priest to hear the person's confession.
Okay, so the answer is we don't know what sacraments angels may or may not be able to perform. There are reports of angels bringing people Holy Communion, in which case they're serving as an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion, only since they're an angel rather than a human, they would be a really extraordinary minister of Holy Communion. This is reported, for example, in the case of the Fatima children. They reported an angel bringing them communion before the Virgin Mary began appearing to them. In terms of the priest anecdote that you mentioned, there are all other similar anecdotes. For example, of Padre Pio bilocating. He was in his community, you know, physically, but then a young woman went to confession in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, and he was her confessor, and he was in, apparently in two places at one time. Later, when she visited Padre Pio, he spoke to her and said, "Remember when you came to me for confession in Rome?" And so he was conscious of being in both places at once. And theologians have debated whether it's possible for a human body to literally be in more than one place at a time in the normal space-extended mode that human bodies are in, you know, where like my body is 6 feet tall and 2 feet from shoulder to shoulder and or whatever and things like that. Not all theologians, in fact, my impression is historically most theologians have been of the opinion that it's not possible for a human body to be present in two places, to be literally present in two places at once in that normal spatially extended way. And so the second body, the one that's present in the second location, is often thought to be a kind of vision or apparition of the person, and that's how bilocation operates. It may even be tangible. You might be able to touch it and sense it with detect it with the sense of touch, just like you can detect it with the sense of vision, but it's still not something that's physically real. It's something that would be an apparition. And that can certainly work with confession, since the sacrament is based on information exchange. You know, you don't have a physical object like water or bread or wine that gets used in the sacrament. Instead, you exchange information. The penitent exchanges the information of here's what I did and I'm genuinely sorry for it. And the priest then declares the person forgiven. So it's an information-based sacrament. And it thus, at least one could suppose, it could be performed in this kind of way via an apparition. And we do have reports of that. In the case of the story that Damon relates of a priest who says, "I was nowhere near the church," you know, I would say that's probably right. This probably wasn't a case of the priest bilocating. Otherwise, I would think he would be aware of it. But I would also wonder about natural explanations, like could it have been a case of mistaken identity? Could the penitent have seen a priest who looked a lot like or sounded a lot like this other priest and thought it was him when it really wasn't. At least that's something I would do if I, that's a question I would ask if I was doing a parapsychological investigation of the case. But supposing it wasn't a case of mistaken identity and it wasn't a case of bilocation, then an angel would be a logical explanation. And that would, in that case, provide us with some evidence that angels might be able to hear people's confessions. The truth is, we don't know what they can do. We know that they are other intelligent, you know, rational creatures, just like we are. They don't have bodies, but they do have the ability to affect matter telekinetically or psychokinetically. It's possible that God could ordain angels to the priesthood, or that they are intrinsically members of the heavenly priesthood. And even though they're not humans, that's something I can't rule out. It's a little odd, since they're not members of the human family, to have them, especially if they were like consecrating the Eucharist, which is Jesus's body and blood, and thus involves his humanity, which they don't have. But just because something is odd doesn't mean God can't do it. God's omnipotent, and so he can do what he chooses.
Damon, thank you. Thanks very much for that question. It's open forum. This next one comes from Kellyanne, who asks, we are to love our enemies. If they are under the influence of evil, which parts of the enemy are we to love? Their potential? Their soul in need of repair?
So it's possible to love parts of somebody, like they had those commercials back in the 80s or something. Gee, your hair smells terrific. You know, for some kind of shampoo, I forget what. So you could say, oh, I love the way your hair smells. Or you might think that the way the person has arranged their hair is visually attractive. And you might say, I love your hair, or I love your eyes, or whatever, or I love your sense of humor. But those particular things are, when we say we love those, we just mean we're attracted to them. And that's different than the kind of personal love that we're called to give human beings and in general. When we love someone, we're not called to have rosy feelings. You know, a parent, let's say, Cy Kellett, you've got a young son, and your son is in danger of a raging river, and you've got to dive in to save your son from drowning. Well, probably in that moment, you don't have rosy feelings. You're right. Probably scared and anxious and terrified for what might happen to your son. There's no rosy feelings there. But nevertheless, you are loving your son by rescuing him. And you're loving him in a profound way. And the underlying principle of what you're doing, which is the underlying principle of true love, of interpersonal love, is you're willing the good of the other person. You're willing that your son be saved from the raging river. That's a good that you're trying to secure for him. And that's what we do whenever we love someone in the love your neighbor sense. We're not called to be attracted to their hair or their eyes or their odor. We're called to will their good. And so if someone is committing sin, whether they're under demonic influence or they're just doing it on their own, we're called to will their good. And that's not directed in principle to any particular part of their being. It's a love for the person as a whole.
Kellyanne, what a great question. Thank you very, very much. Onward we go. It's Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. And this one comes from RJ. I'm curious about whether an enclave to elect a new pope starts with any kind of list, or if it is completely a completely organic movement of the Holy Spirit. I want to believe the latter is the case, but humans are a practical bunch. Thanks, Jimmy.
So there are sort of two starting lists. The broader one is the membership of the College of Cardinals. It is not required that the new pope be a member of the College of Cardinals, but it has been that way for centuries. And, you know, every pope has been a previous member of the College of Cardinals for a very long time. And that's the starting point for picking a pope for practical purposes. There have been cases where conclaves elected someone who was not a cardinal. But that's been a very rare circumstance, especially in recent church history. And it was only because they couldn't find a cardinal that they thought would be a good guy. They were like deadlocked over different cardinal candidates. So they finally compromised by picking someone who's not even a member of the College of Cardinals. But so for practical purposes, this sort of the starting list is the membership of the College of Cardinals. And the basis of that is not only are they the guys who have the vote, but because of their role in the church, they also have broad experience or are supposed to have broad experience of the church at its highest levels. And therefore, they could, you know, they have the sort of on the job experience of what it's like to work for the church at these high levels. And thus, they reasonably could assume it the highest level of the papacy and not be completely unfamiliar with what a pope is supposed to do. In fact, one of the cases where they did elect someone who was not a member of the college, they elected this guy who was a monk, and he had written them and said, come on, guys, you got to break your deadlock. And they said, okay, you're it. And he was not a cardinal. He did not have experience working for the church at the highest level. He had the experience of living holed up in a monastery, and that's really what he wanted to do. And he completely got on the job and then completely realized, I'm not cut out for this. I don't have the background for this. And he resigned and went back to living in a monastery. In fact, he was imprisoned in a monastery. This was Pope Celestine V. And so there are some good reasons to, at least in principle, start with the membership of the College of Cardinals. However, there's a second smaller list that is often discussed leading up to the conclave, which is, and this is an unofficial list, it's not in any one place, and different people would put different people on it, but it's common for people before a conclave and before a pope is even out of office to speculate who would make a good next pope. And so, you know, who could we imagine being a good pope or an electable pope that would come next? And these individuals are known as papabiles, which just means they're popable. You could make them pope. And you'll see different lists of papabiles. You know, Vaticanologists and journalists will come up with lists of people based on discussions that people are always having about, you know, who do you think would be good next? And so that'll be another kind of starting list that'll be in the minds of some of the cardinals in the conclave. There also are discussions that happen between the cardinals during the interregnum. After a pope has died or resigned, the cardinals get together and they have discussions before they formally go into conclave about what does the church need. And that's going to involve some discussion of who do you think could provide for those needs? Who do you think would be a good pope? So there are some starting considerations, but things can go in very different directions. There is an old saying that the man who goes into a conclave as pope comes out as a cardinal. And that reflects the truth that a lot of the time the cardinals don't react well to guys who act like they're entitled to the papacy. But it also reflects the truth that things can just go in unexpected directions. You know, if there's a deadlock between major candidates, a minor candidate might emerge. And so we can't predict with certainty who's going to come out.
Thank you very much, RJ, for that question. This one comes from Martin. Is Jesus prefigured in Genesis chapter 3, verse 8, walking in the Garden of Eden?
So, not in the literal sense of the text, it wouldn't seem, because God doesn't literally have, you know, I should say, as the Catechism acknowledges, early Genesis contains a lot of figurative symbolic language. And so we can't be confident here that we have a literal theophany where God literally generated a physical form. If he did, then it could be any of the three persons of the Trinity animating that form, or all of them. They could be cooperating in animating that form. But it wouldn't have been identified to the author of Genesis as Jesus. the author of Genesis did not know about Jesus. He was writing 1,000 years or more before Jesus, so he didn't have Jesus in his mind. And so on the literal sense of the text, which is what the author intends to communicate, he's not trying to communicate anything about Jesus. Now, if you want to say, could this in the spiritual sense, which is what God is aware of and what God is hinting at through the text, could God have been pointing forward that he would one day take physical form and that would be Jesus? Well, you could propose that. I don't know how you would prove that, but you could propose it, and it's not inconsistent with what God knew would be happening later in salvation history. So I would say that that's, you know, a possibility, but it's not something that's clearly evident in the text.
Oh, Martin, thank you very, very much for that question. Perfect timing on that, Jimmy. That brings us to the break. We've got a whole bunch of great questions, and I'm not just saying that. I've actually read ahead. We do have great questions. Jimmy Akin here to answer them. Internet Open Forum continues right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Are you ready to defend your faith in a world of unbelief? Join us at the 9th Annual Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference. This year's theme, I Believe in God, and it'll help you provide clear and charitable answers to atheism, agnosticism, and plain old indifference. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us in San Diego from September 21st through 24th as we welcome our special guest, Dr. Scott Hahn, and an all-star lineup of great Catholic speakers. Spend quality time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and enjoy 4 days of fun, fellowship, and adoration of the Almighty. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register. Enter promo code EARLY and save $50. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's here, the host of Jimmy Akin's. Well, I shouldn't say the host. I guess the host. There's two hosts.
I am the host.
I never know because
Dom is my co. I am the host. Dom is my co-host.
There we go. There we go. Of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which you can find at mysterious.fm. The new episode is on Black Elk tomorrow. Medicine Man, Black Elk, and some mysterious stuff about Black Elk. So check it out, mysterious.fm. All of our questions today come from the internet. There are a lot of them, and this one comes from Taylor. Is it correct to assume that eternal life means one single mode of living once in heaven? To what realistic end? Or is it possible that heaven can mean new job-like activities leading to higher modes of living? To be clear, I do not mean reincarnation. I mean a sort of life enrichment where life continues to bear fruit even at higher merit-based stages of existence. Consider the choirs of angels. What is the culmination of eternal life? Is there a culmination which bears a fruit? What is the fruit which has meaning?
Okay, so a lot of this we can't really know at the present stage because we haven't been told that much about the afterlife. And what we have been told is accommodated to our present level of understanding. Our brains really aren't configured at present to process what the afterlife is like. And so when, for example, scripture describes it, it uses images that convey a sense of what eternal life will be like, but without being necessarily what's literally going to be the case. For example, the book of Revelation, in describing the heavenly city, New Jerusalem, says it has streets of transparent gold and transparent aluminum maybe, but gold isn't really transparent. And it describes there being a river that goes through the city that has the tree of life on both sides. And it says the leaves of the tree of life will be used for the healing of the nations. Okay, so that, but if this is heaven, why is there any sickness that needs to be healed? So This is probably a symbol of good health being provided for everybody, for all the nations, but not literally like you're going to get sick in heaven and need to be healed with a literal leaf. So a lot of this we can't know, but what we are told is that we will reign with Christ. And that implies that there is going to be activity for us to do. Reigning involves administration. And so there will be at least administrative tasks for the faithful to do. Also, if you look at Jesus's parables, like in the Gospel of Luke, for example, in the parable of the talents, you have the master, when one servant is faithful with, you know, five talents, he gets put in charge of five cities. And when another servant is faithful with 10 talents, he gets put in charge of 10 cities. And so, you know, that, as well as other passages, suggest there are different levels of reward in heaven. And if you look at that specific parable where you have a master who has servants who then administer or reign over different numbers of cities, that could be one of the rewards. You get more responsibility in the afterlife, if a higher position in the afterlife, if you've done well in this one. Can we progress in the afterlife from one level to another, or are we sort of stuck at a given level? I think the answer to that is not known. It's possible that there could be a form of eternal growth where, you know, as we accomplish various tasks for God, we're given then more to do. And, you know, it's like kind of like building on a foundation. If you start with the foundation of a house, you build the next level, and it gets taller and taller. And the same thing could be true of our efforts reigning with Christ in the afterlife. We could, for example, progressively spread his dominion over the cosmos or something like that. At least it's a possibility. One thing that I would be careful of is Taylor mentions merit-based stages of existence. And there's a little bit of a complication here, because the standard theological opinion has been that the time for merit is in this life. The way that's classically expressed is theologians will say you need to be in a wayfaring state, meaning you're still traveling on the road, you're still heading towards God in heaven, in order to do merit. And so we won't be meriting in heaven. But that means we won't be meriting in the sense that we merit in this life. First of all, I should say that's just a theological opinion. That's not church teaching as far as I know. But also, there are other ways of meriting. And so you could say, well, okay, in the afterlife, we're going to be perfect. And let's say Jesus gives me a 5-year commission to administer 5 cities. And I do a good job. Since I'm perfect, I do a good job administering those 5 cities. And after that, he says, okay, now you get to have a 10-year commission, or you get to do 10 cities. And I could progress based on doing a good job, but everybody would be doing a good job. And so it would be meriting in a different way than we do in this life, where not everybody does a good job. And, you know, some people are more holy than others. So I think progression in the afterlife is possible, but I think it's something that's is
at least in terms of classical Catholic theological opinion, is going to be understood. It would need to be understood in terms of it's something everyone participates in to the fullness of their capability.
Taylor, I hope that was helpful and got to what you were looking for, because I really enjoyed that question. Thank you very, very much for that question. It's always something to hear what we do know and what we don't know. And the what we don't know category is a big category when it comes to the afterlife. So it's really fun to speculate on, Taylor, and thank you. I'm going to go to Chris's question. I was received into full communion with the Catholic Church this year. Congratulations, Chris.
Congratulations, yeah.
What does St. Paul mean in Romans chapter 4, verse 6 about the crediting of righteousness?
Okay, so in a situation like this, we need to read the text. Now, at the beginning of Romans 4, Paul has been talking about the example of Abraham and how Abraham was made righteous or justified through faith in God, not through circumcision or other works of the Mosaic law. And then he pivots in verse 6 to say, just as David also speaks about the blessing of the person to whom God credits righteousness apart from works. And then he quotes from the Psalms, which are classically attributed or ascribed to David. And the psalm he's quoting from says, blessed are those whose lawless deeds have been forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the person against whom the Lord will never count sin. So so Paul is turning to the Psalms to document that a sinner can be forgiven. And in this text in the psalm, the sinner doesn't have, he's not getting circumcised, he's not doing other works of the law in order to be forgiven. And so it's possible to have your lawless deeds forgiven. And this doesn't mean you've got to obey the Mosaic law and keep kosher and do all those things, because those aren't mentioned here. In terms of crediting, so here we encounter a translation issue. The Greek word that is used at this point in the text is logizomai or logizomai. And it can mean credit, but credit... It can also mean a bunch of other things. And credit is a term that we use in an economic context. And, you know, we think about credits and debits and accounting books and ledgers and things like that. And this has led to a lot of preaching, particularly in the Protestant community, that uses an economic, a highly economic metaphor for justification, where God, you've got this big debt of sins, like in tables in an economic logbook, and God applies, so those are debits, so God applies credits to those and cancels them all out. And in fact, he you'll even encounter some preachers who will say things like, you know, God credits to you all of the righteousness of Jesus Christ, so he looks at you as if you're just like Jesus, which the Bible nowhere says. Christ has the name above every name, and God doesn't give you that. So he's not looking at you just like he looks at his son Jesus. That's clearly an exaggeration. But this sort of logbook metaphor is not really found in the text here. It would all hinge on this one word, credit. And just because you have a credit, even in English, doesn't mean you're thinking of a logbook. You know, this is an extension or extrapolation of what of the metaphor they assume is in the text. But the problem is that logizomai can mean more than credit. It also commonly means reckon. And to reckon something just means to consider it. You know, I may reckon that Cy Kellett is wearing a blue shirt because I can see he's wearing a blue shirt. And so that's my reckoning of the situation. That's a blue shirt. And so, and there are a bunch of other possible translations of logizomai in English. You can't just camp out on one of them and use it as a dominant metaphor for understanding what Paul is saying when it's so sensitive to what translation you're using. You have to consider what's the basic meaning of the word, how does it get used in different contexts, and what does it mean in this particular context. And I don't think that we can say that it must mean the economic sort of logbook metaphor here, because other translations use other terms here. They don't all say credit. That's in some translations, but not others. Other translations will say God reckoned righteous, God reckons righteousness apart from works. And so the reckoning can mean various things, including imputing, meaning attributing to something, even if it's whether or not it's there for reals. It also doesn't answer the question for us of, is this reckoning something that makes us righteous, or is it in spite of the fact that we remain unrighteous? That's a question that this text doesn't engage at all. So you'd have to appeal to other considerations to sort out that question. So I think Paul's point is, the point Paul's trying to make is, you can be reckoned righteous by God, you can be justified by God, even without performing works of the Mosaic law. And he's citing the example of David in support of that in this passage. But beyond that, you can't draw a lot of sweeping inferences. This is not a good text to build a major theory of how justification works on. It really only is covering a very small aspect of how justification works.
Chris, thank you. That brings us to the break. We'll take a break and be right back with more with Jimmy Akin. It's an Internet Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hi, this is Doug Keck on Mother Angelica Answering the Call. Father Joseph Mary and I mine decades of phone calls answered by Mother Angelica. Join us Sunday for a half hour of teaching, advice, laughter, and plenty of prayers from the one and only Mother Angelica.
Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Sunday afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Working our way through all the questions the internet has. We'll see if we can exhaust them by the end, but I don't think we will. Lots and lots of questions from the internet. We like that, and we love when Jimmy is here to answer them. This one comes from Jennifer. If Jesus knew everything because he is God, when it says that the Son of Man does not know the hour in Matthew 24:36, what does that really mean? How did he not know?
Okay, so everybody agrees that in Jesus's divine intellect, he's omniscient, and so he knows everything. And so in his divine intellect, he did know the hour. We also probably should say a word about what the hour is that is being discussed. This statement occurs in the Sermon on the Mount. I'm sorry, in the Olivet Discourse. And the Olivet Discourse, as it's found in Mark and Luke and in Matthew 24, is not about the end of the world. People commonly interpret it as being about the end of the world, but if you read it in context, it ain't. It's about the destruction of the temple. And so what Jesus is actually saying is that neither the angels in heaven, no man, nor the angels in heaven, nor the Son knows the hour when the temple is going to be destroyed. Now, the same thing may well be true of the end of the world. But that's not what Jesus is saying here. This is in Matthew 24, which parallels Mark 13 and Luke 21. And so it's talking about the destruction of the temple. The material that genuinely does deal with the end of the world is in Matthew 25, which is the next chapter. But here he's talking about the destruction of the temple. He says, no one knows exactly when it's going to happen. It's going to happen in this generation, but nobody knows exactly when. Now, as I said, everybody agrees he knew in his divine intellect. And so what he's saying here must pertain in some way, or at least a plausible line of interpretation for this text, is he's talking in some capacity about his human nature or his human capacity as the Messiah. Because in addition to his divine intellect, he also has a human intellect. And classically, Catholic theologians have agreed that his human intellect, since it's human, it's finite. It can't contain all information. But there's a difference of opinion about exactly what he means here. The classical sort of view that you'll find among medieval theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas is that even though he's doesn't have all knowledge of all possible worlds, because that would be an infinite amount of knowledge and a human intellect can't contain an infinite amount of knowledge, he does, on their view, have all knowledge of the actual world. So he knows absolutely everything about the actual world. And that's a sort of, I guess you could say, omniscience pertaining to the actual world. He knows everything about the actual world. So it's all knowledge, omniscience, but it's a restricted form of omniscience. He knows everything about the real world. Well, since the temple was going to be destroyed at some point in the real world, he would know when that would be in his human intellect if he has this kind of restricted omniscience. And so people who endorse this view would say he means something. He doesn't literally mean he doesn't know. What he means is something like he's not been sent to reveal that information. And so that's what he's doing here. He's saying, you know, I don't know it in the, this is like a mental reservation. I don't know it in the sense that I don't know it for purposes of revealing it to you. And so that's sort of the classic way of handling this. I find that very unsatisfying.
Yeah.
Why would he use this mental reservation? Why would he use language like this? The other view is that Jesus's human knowledge does not include real world omniscience, that he doesn't know everything about the real world. You find this not among people like Aquinas, but among more modern theologians like Hans Urs von Balthasar and Joseph Ratzinger. So the more modern view is that Jesus did have supernatural knowledge in his human intellect, but he only had that supernatural knowledge that he had been sent to reveal, that pertained directly to his mission. So that's why on this view, he needs to ask questions for, like, who touched me and things like that. It's because he's not doing some elaborate show. He genuinely doesn't know who touched him because he was not sent to reveal who touched him. It's, you know, it's something that happened unexpectedly. And so he needed to ask and inquire. And the catechism seems to take this line. If you look at the section on Jesus's human knowledge in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it seems to endorse this more restricted understanding of Jesus's human knowledge. And it says that what he confessed to not knowing. So the catechism acknowledges he didn't know it. I mean, confess is a factative verb, so it indicates truth. He's genuinely being truthful when he says he doesn't know. And it says what he confessed to not knowing in this area, he elsewhere said he was not sent to reveal. So that's why he doesn't know it. It's because he wasn't sent to reveal this information. That's not part of his mission. So he didn't download that information from his divine intellect into his human intellect. And that would be my preferred solution to the passage.
Jennifer, thank you very much for that question. Appreciate it. On we go. It's an internet open forum, and this one comes from Tony. Hi, Jimmy. Scrupulous people have a hard time dealing with uncertainty, risks, and probabilities. If they don't have absolute certainty, they fear they're going to miss something, whether it be a mortal, it would be a mortal sin to confess, or a small particle of the sacred host on their hands, or something. Could you please give some advice on how to deal with uncertainty? Thank you.
Sure. And I can try to put it different ways, but forgive me if this sounds a little abrupt, it's meant humorously, but the basic solution is suck it up. Because life is risk and we got to get used to dealing with it. And I understand about, you know, having anxieties and things like that. I mean, I've been through very traumatic experiences in my own life where my wife was dying, for example. You better believe that caused anxiety. And so despite what I just said, I have a lot of compassion for this. I understand anxiety and fear and what it's like to, you know, fear risk. Ultimately, though, I came to a point where I realized, as Gandalf said in Lord of the Rings, no one is guaranteed a time. You know, my wife died at age 27, and life does involve risk, and you have a choice. There's no way to avoid the fact of risk. You can try to minimize it, but if you can't focus too much on trying to minimize risk, because if you do, you will become paralyzed. You'll live in a shell. You won't engage. One of the reasons we undertake risk is because it leads to good things. You know, if you, let's say you're a hunter-gatherer and you need food, like all people do. Well, being a hunter-gatherer, if you don't have a lot of plants to gather at the moment, you need to go hunting. But going hunting can be dangerous. There are risks associated with hunting. If you and your fellow hunter-gatherers like are trying to take down a mammoth, well, okay, the mammoth is a dangerous animal. It could kill some of you, and you might be one of the ones that gets killed. So going mammoth hunting involves undertaking a risk. But what it also does is it gets us food for us and our tribe and our families and our kids. And so risk properly undertaken leads to good. And if you try to avoid all risk, you will end up avoiding all goods, because there aren't any, there are very few risks, very few goods, I should say, that don't entail any risk in undertaking them. And so you would leave a deprived, impoverished life. And that is not God's will for us. In fact, that's something else that Jesus covers in the parable of the talents. In the parable of the talents, you know, you have the master who's going away on a journey, and he entrusts his property to three of his servants. He gives one of them 10 talents, one of them 5 talents, and one of them 1 talent. And he's proportioned this according to their ability to manage these things. And the two who get the 10 and the 5, they go out and make 10 and 5 more. But the guy who has the 1 has anxiety about risk. He's afraid if he invests this money, he's going to lose it and get in trouble. So instead of investing it, he hides it and makes no return on that. So when his master comes back, all he can say is, here it is, I kept it for you. And the master did not give it to him for the purposes of keeping it. He gave it to him for the purpose of growing it. And he was afraid of the risk and didn't grow it. And as a result, he ends up not in a favored position with the master. And what this shows us is God wants us to undertake risk. He's given us our abilities, our talents in the modern sense of the term talent, so that we can use them to do good things in the world. And that builds his kingdom and that pleases him. And so now I should note, in the parable, the master is a hard man. He's not really a good guy. But what God is doing there is using, it's sometimes called an a fortiori argument. It's like, if this is true, how much more is this other thing true? So if even a bad master wants you to perform, a good master will want you to perform, but not in a berating way, but he wants you to perform. He wants you to undertake risk and use the talents he gave you to do good. So you need to go out and embrace risk. And it's okay if you fail. We can't be paralyzed by fear of failure. God understands. He knows that that risk entails not only risk of success, but risk of failure. And so it's okay. He's fine with that. Don't worry. You know, relax, trust God, trust Him to provide for you in the future, and go forth boldly and seize the day.
Tony, thanks very, very much for the question. Great way to end that first hour. Second hour, we've got a whole bunch more open forum for you. It's internet open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. So I will not, well, I say I won't give out the phone number, but I'm not supposed to give out the phone number. I might by accident, but we're not taking calls today because Edgar's getting married today. It's wedding day. And right now I am probably actually doing the electric slide on the dance floor. Right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.